sure the filings there is not going to be on chapter 1 through 6, just chapter 7 and 8?
Yep. But on the positive side, I mean, all this stuff builds on itself. So if you really understand the stuff from chapters 1 through 6 and you're comfortable with the problems, then chapter 7 and 8, you should be able to work those problems out without any problem.
Only if they're monkey problems.
Unfortunately, I think all the monkey problems are in chapter 5. There might be one in chapter 6, though. But I don't know. I don't know. If I think up a good monkey problem, I'll put it on there. How about that?
I need one to pass. At least one question I can do.
But truth is, the gravitational wave stuff and the cosmology stuff is really a lot easier than the stuff from the other chapter 5 and 6. And what I'm planning on is the last couple lectures. One is going to be on chapter 7 and one's going to be on chapter 8. But you should plan on doing some reading on those chapters too. So even though the problems I'm going to give you for the final exam are going to be mostly from the beginning of those chapters. Okay. So the idea of the final is not so much to test whether or not you can, just listen to me and regurgitate stuff from class. It's to kind of test your ability to synthesize the material and learn from it to do the other stuff. You know, before I taught this class during the semester, I actually gave the final exam was just the problems from chapter 5 and 6. Okay. So, to start chapter 5, we're going to be talking today about the Schwarzschild solution, which, you know, some of you know is the black hole solution. And so the idea of the Schwarzschild solution really at first had nothing to do with black holes. The idea was to approximate the gravitational field outside of the Earth and outside of the Sun, and therefore you can understand our local gravitational field and get something that looks like Newtonian gravity, but maybe or the Einstein equivalent of Newtonian gravity. And so the Schwarzschild metric... So the Schwarzschild solution is spherically symmetric, and it's an empty space. So it's a vacuum solution. The Schwarzschild metric is the unique spherically symmetric vacuum solution to Einstein's equation. And so by unique, I mean that if you put in, you want a spherically symmetric solution that has kind of a center point to it, for a point source gravitational object, then you get this one Schwarzschild solution. And it's the same thing as if you put in a single charge in an electromagnetic system, you get a Coulomb potential. And so the idea is that this is the only solution that could come out, and if it wasn't unique, then it really wouldn't work. So this is the full Schwarzschild solution as it's written, where this d omega are the radial coordinates. M, excuse me, is the mass of the gravitating object, which is the thing that's at the center. And in a vacuum, what that means is that the right-hand side of Einstein's equations are zero. So the stress-energy tensor is zero. And therefore, the Ricci tensor is going to come out to be zero. And that's sort of what that implies. That does not mean that the metric zero. That just means that overall, this is what you're going to get. Because it effectively ends up being zero curvature, even though you see this real curvature.
That is a zero, right?
That's zero. Yeah. Also, another thing about this is that the source has got to be static and spherically symmetric. Because when they came up with the Schwarzschild solution, it basically assumed that the solar system... doesn't change. That the sun, whatever the source of gravity is, it's static, it's not changing, and that it's a perfect sphere. And to first order, you can approximate things like that. And so static basically means it's not moving. It's not traveling anywhere. So you can say, for example, that when you look at the cross terms in the metric, where you have G0 and one of the coordinates, and that's kind of like saying partially time-like, partly in the time-like direction, partially in the spatial direction, those are both going to be zero. And it's time symmetric, which means that if you flip the direction of time, you're going to get the same thing. And so you'd also, you don't have any space-time cross terms, but you also really shouldn't have any spatial cross terms either, because there's no twist going on there, and because it's spherically symmetric. And so if we take a spherically symmetric Minkowski space-time, you get this. And this is just simply the metric for sphere. If I had a globe here, this is exactly what it would look like. What you do is, if this thing is spherically symmetric, you modify that by just simply adding these exponential terms onto each one. And the reason why they're using exponentials here is because, first off, an exponential is never going to be negative. So it's only, it can go from zero to infinity.
Why is the first one subtracted?
Oh, because that's time.
Okay.
So we still have the same signature, and it's still spherically symmetric. And you can see that if you take these exponential terms and you set them, the argument of exponential to zero, then this would just collapse down to a spherical space-time. But you also notice that there's no time in any of these variables, in alpha, beta, or gamma. And the reason why is because, you know, if you want this to be time symmetric, you can't have time in there.
Why do we put the exponentials in?
Because even though you know it's going to collapse down to looking like the Minkowski in spherical coordinates, you know that it's not exactly. So the exponentials are just there to kind of put a placeholder on variables this could satisfy. And we didn't, I mean, they initially they told them the exponential, I think, so that, because they don't want, you know, time to end up looking like space and all the other
ways. Oh, those are basically the terms of the metric.
Right, these
okay.
are the metric terms. So the metric terms are, you know, e to the 2 alpha, e to the 2 beta, e to the 2 gamma, etc. Or with, you know, whatever else in there. And so what we do is we do a change of coordinates. And we're going to do r prime is equal to e to the gamma r, r. And the reason why is because it will get rid of this term and just replace it with an r squared. R squared, or r prime squared. And so when you do that, dr prime is going to be written long like this, because it's going to be, you know, you're taking the derivatives of dr bar here, and you use a chain rule, so you get all this stuff. And so this dr bar tells you that if you take this dr bar and you use it to replace this term, then you're going to get this new metric. And so what they've done is they say, well, if you could take R bar and you turn it back into a new R, then what happens is this whole thing, this big ugly thing here, can be just replaced by the 2 beta. And you end up with the same metric, but you see that it doesn't change, so you kind of got rid of the exponential gamma term here. So it was just a series of coordinate transformations to kind of simplify everything. Yeah?
Could you go back up the R, D gamma, DR, the fourth line down.
Here?
Yeah, the next term, the plus, what that. Are you using that whole right-hand side to replace?
Just take this and put it over here. So basically divide it through by dr and multiply by dr and factor out the common terms. So these two are algebraically equivalent.
And then, but what did you replace it at the top up there? You replaced something in equation.
Oh, form? All that did was just take your R bar here. You needed to use when we took our change of coordinates here. We basically had to replace the dr that's here with this thing with the dr bar.
You skipped a step where you solve for dr in terms of dr bar.
Right. And so you have to and so that's why we got to this. And that's why you got this 2 beta, epsilon 2 beta term here.
Well, the 2 beta was already up there. That's why it's epsilon. It's either 2 beta minus 2 beta.
Right.
That part didn't change.
Right. And so basically you have the dr in terms of dr bar, and that's why this is inverted here. See? And then you have the minus the gamma term.
So I understand r bar you took in dr bar. You want to define r bar with the meaning r times the exponential does something for you.
Oh.
Oh, it changed your coordinates.
It changes the coordinates here to get up to here. You know, so basically the idea was to get rid of this term on the d omega.
So that's why they did that.
So that last term, if you wrote it, it would be just r bar r d omega squared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think they kind of skipped. Well, no, actually they did actually specify that in the book, too.
And then this was the step where if you took R bar back to R, then it basically said that, you know, it's like gamma is equal to zero, in which case this just becomes e to the 2 beta, which is simplifying it back down. So one thing they do a lot in relativity is you see a lot of coordinate changes and then coordinate unchanges, and that's what they have to do.
So the minus 2, yeah, if that's minus 2 times 0, it's just 0. So it's just, that's how they got rid of that second term.
Yeah, they basically said if R bar is equal to R, then you get back to the 2, either 2 beta. Which makes sense, because if this is a function you don't understand, and you don't understand what it is, then you could say it's equal to 0. Because it's not affecting any of the other terms.
So that was a little like magic. You start up there with e to the 2 gamma as a function of r, I guess. Is that
as a function of r.
And then you get rid of the 2 gamma.
Mm-hmm.
You're letting gamma go to 0.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but we had to kind of explain why we were allowed to do that. Because we couldn't arbitrarily have done that. We couldn't have just gone from here to here without these steps in between, because we had to justify why it is we could get rid of.
Well, you could if you just assumed gamma was 0.
Yeah, but that's kind of cheating, isn't it? Because I mean, we could assume that beta is equal to 0 too. If that were the case, then that wouldn't really get us anywhere. The idea was that once you got to this stage here, then you could, at this point, that's when you can kind of say, well, this should be equivalent to this. Okay? And if you assume, well, you know that these two have to be equivalent to each other. And if you take, if you look at the last term and you say, well, R bar is equal to R, then that kind of implies that this must be equal to just 2 beta.
Well, this is the same as the first one, except with gamma equals 0.
Yeah. Or you could, so basically you're basically just assuming. You have to kind of go through some kind of logic there. But effectively, it's the same thing as saying your gamma is equal to 0.
And then dr in the middle term should be dr squared.
Where? Here?
No, down. 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 One more. Down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, that should be dr squared.
Yes, you are right.
That should be a dr squared.
Oh, because that term didn't change.
Yeah, it didn't change. It just was a matter of me not doing it right. Okay, so this is our metric that we're dealing with. We only have the alpha and the beta. Basically eliminate the gamma. So the next thing we do is we solve for our Christoffel symbols.
And
not to bore you with the details, because you've already been through this enough, you calculate them out, and you can see that these are the 9 Christoffel symbols you're going to get from it, where obviously you only have 3 things. Basically, there's T, there's R, and then there's the angular terms. And so with these 3 things, you're able to come up with all the different possible non-zero combinations. Anything that you don't see up here is 0.
So there's T, R, and
theta? T, R, theta, and phi. And so if you notice, for example, if I had T, R, theta in my Christoffel symbol, that's 0 because it's not up here.
And so once you've calculated your Christoffel symbols, then that's when you can use those and calculate your Riemann tensors.
And so the Riemann tensors, these are the only non-zero Riemann tensor terms that come out of that. And you can see, again, these are in terms of alpha, beta, R, theta, and phi. But it's spherically symmetric, so really, there's no phi terms on the right-hand side.
Just like when we looked at the Christoffel symbols,
you'll notice that there's no phi terms over here. And that just comes from the fact that you have asymmutal symmetry, so nothing's really a function of phi.
When we do...
if it's spherically symmetric, wouldn't the data drop out too?
No. So anyway, when we get to talking about spinning black holes, then the phi term will actually be in there. All right. And so then, once you got your Riemann, you can contract them and get your Ricci terms. And so you can see there's 4 Ricci tensor terms. And the reason why there's 4 is because, again, this is a diagonal metric. You have TT, RR, theta, theta, and phi, phi. And there's no other ones. So you can see these are the 4.
The Ricci tensor always diagonal?
No. Only if the metric is diagonal. If your metric is not diagonal, then you... And let me kind of quickly show you why. If
you think about it, in order to contract to get the Ricci, you have to contract over the first and the third elements of the Riemann. And you can see that in each of the non-zero ones, they're all the same. And I don't think it's really a coincidence that that's true. But I think what happens is that when you look at something like this, if you're using the metric to raise or lower the terms of the Riemann, and the metric's diagonal, then it's always going to raise this one up to be the same thing.
So I think that
in every case I've seen, if you have a diagonal metric, you're going to get a diagonal Riemann, Ricci.
Sure, if we wrote the Riemann tensor in terms of the Christoffel symbols, and wrote that in terms of that metric, we would see that the off-diagonal terms would...
And then you could take these Ricci tensor terms and you, raise an index, using the metric, and you contract over that, and you get the Ricci scalar. And so this is the Ricci scalar in terms of... alpha and beta. And you notice all the theta and phi and all that's disappeared now in the scalar. I mean, the only theta term even existing is over here, the R phi phi term.
And so the neat thing about this is, I mean, you have to go through this every time you solve Einstein's equations for something like this. I mean, you literally have to, if you have a metric, you have to kind of work your way through to get it up to Einstein's equation. That means solving the Riemann and the Christoffel symbols and everything. This is why Mathematica or Maple are just the greatest thing for this stuff. Because you can actually do all this tensor manipulation really easily with it. Yeah?
The bottom equation, minus 2 and the exponent. Now, is that next letter a bracket with no closing bracket or an I?
Oh, that's a bracket.
Where is it smashed?
Oh. Sorry about that.
And the terms are contracted from all the terms in the Ricci tensor.
Right.
and use a metric to contract?
Mm-hmm. Basically, what I did was I would put the metric, inverse metric term like this, and contract with that.
Okay.
And so when you put in the inverse metric, then you can contract it, and then you sum over all the different variables. And so really, this is equal to GIJ, RIJ.
Summation over all.
So it's a summation over all. So this effectively ends up being RTT plus RRR, etc. And you're just summing over the diagonals with each one of these, which is effectively the same thing as just multiplying the appropriate metric term or inverse metric term by each one of these guys. And so like I said, I mean, you can, this is one of these things, doing it by hand is incredibly long and tedious. Getting Maple or Mathematica to do it, I mean, you program it once, and then you can actually write a little Maple or Mathematica program where you give it the metric you want, and it'll spit out the Riemann and the Ricci scalar and tensor and everything along the way. Of course, it doesn't seem to work for the student version. I think it's the $700 or $800 version of it that they intentionally handicap the student version because they don't want you to get too much for your money. But, or at least they used to. So we know, since it's a vacuum solution, that the Ricci is going to be equal to zero, the Ricci scalar. And so therefore, the Ricci, each of the Ricci terms, RTT and RRR, are both equal to zero. And therefore, if you multiply RTT by a constant plus RRR, you're going to get zero. And so what we've done here is we've said, well, if we take RTT and we multiply it by this exponential, e to the beta minus alpha, and like this, and you subtract RRR from that, then you could see that that's going to add up to zero. And that result, if you do that math, basically get rid of this exponential here, and then add these two terms together. These two cancel out, these two cancel out, these two cancel out, and then the last terms are going to add together, and what they add together to be is going to be zero. So this is going to be zero, which means that you can get rid of this 2 over r term, and you can see that these are both derivatives with respect to r. So the integral of these two are basically saying that alpha plus beta is equal to a constant. And so we write that as alpha equals beta plus some constant. And if you say that t is equal to this exponential times t, and that comes from, where is it? Well, basically what they did was they rescaled t to be equal to e to the minus c times t, and that made alpha equal to minus beta. So this came from a rescaling because here you have this exponential of 2 alpha times t, or dt, and so if this is equal to minus beta plus c, then this is effectively going to be equal to something, exponential of something 2 to the beta r, plus a constant, and that extra constant is just multiplying by time. So you can get rid of that time, or that constant, by just saying there's a constant here multiplied by time, and therefore dt is just scaled a little bit. So what they did was they said, well, since this is just a constant, we can get rid of it. We scale it to get rid of it. And when you do, alpha is just equal to minus beta.
And that satisfies everything. Does everybody get that? The rescaling part?
Yeah. It's kind of like if you take pine and, you know, and you, instead of measuring your time in 1 hour blocks, you measure it in 2 hour blocks. It doesn't matter, you're still measuring time. Therefore, you can kind of ignore that extra constant. And so, alpha is equal to minus beta. And so that comes from the fact that RTT and RRR are both equal to zero. The fact that R theta is equal to zero.
If you go look at the Riemann, it says that this whole thing must be equal to zero, which says that 1 is equal to this stuff. And
how do you get R theta equals zero?
Oh, because they're all equal to zero. Because this is equal to zero, therefore R theta has to be equal to zero. And so this is equal to zero, and so then they did some algebra here where they said, well, this is all equal to 1 because they just moved that 1 over the other side. And then they took the alpha, or took the beta, replaced it with alpha, and I guess they just kind of, and also they took alpha and beta equal to the same thing, so this was actually collapsed down into 2r times the derivative of alpha. And then they flipped it over on the other side to, you know, get rid of the minus signs. So this is the exponential e to the 2 alpha bracket 2r partial r of alpha plus 1. And so that means the same thing, that if you take the derivative of r times e to the 2 alpha, it should be equal to 1. And they get that from the chain rule. So you take the derivative of r, get the 2 alpha, take the derivative of the e to the 2 alpha, then you have a factor of 2 in the r from here, and then the derivative of alpha, and then the exponential term. So just kind of a rewriting of that.
And so this is just taking the full derivative of that. And so now, if you integrate this thing, you can get rid of that derivative. And you have the r to e to the 2 alpha is equal to r minus some constant. And so you divide through by r, and you get e to the 2 alpha is equal to 1 minus rs over r, where rs is this constant.
Can you explain that again?
Sure. A lot of algebra here. Okay. So let's say we're starting out with 1 equals minus e to minus 2 beta times r, that's partial r beta minus partial r alpha minus 1.
Okay. And you substitute minus alpha for beta.
Right. So beta equals minus alpha. So that means we have 1 equals minus e to the 2 alpha times r times partial r alpha plus partial r alpha. I'm going to move a minus sign over here, minus 1. And now, this is where I do some algebra. I say, well, I'm going to flip this over to the other side. Well, first I'm going to take the minus sign and multiply it out. So this is going to be equal to e to the 2 alpha r. Well, actually, I'm going to add those two together, and I'm going to get 2r partial r alpha plus 1. Okay? So that's where how I got to this point. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, this is the same thing as saying 2r partial r alpha e to the 2 alpha plus e to the 2 alpha.
Okay, so multiply the e to the 2 alpha
inside of the distributed bracket. So now I could say that this is the same thing as if, what if I took the partial derivative of r e to the 2 alpha? Well, that would be the same thing as saying the chain rule. So the derivative here, which is going to be e to the 2 alpha from the first part, plus, and now from this I have r times 2, and then I have a partial derivative of the denominator, or of what's in the exponential, which is partial r alpha, and these two are the same. So since those two are the same, I can now say that I just have 1 equal to this derivative. So if I integrate both sides of that, well, I'm going to integrate both sides with respect to r. And when you integrate both sides, you integrate the left-hand side here, it's going to be r plus some constant. Integrate the right-hand side, you got an integral and a derivative that cancel each other out. And then I divide through by r, and I have 1 plus rs over r is equal to e to the 2 alpha.
Oh, it's minus rs.
Oh, yeah, I can use a minus, a constant. Yeah. All I have to do is say my constant's negative, and that works. So, if this is e to the 2 alpha, then I plug that back into my original metric, and I have 1 minus rs over r for the first time term. And then, since I have this second term, I've got this term is 2 beta for the r term. And that's like, this is the same thing as, remember, beta equals minus alpha. And so if I have e to the 2 alpha, it's the same thing as e to the minus 2 beta, right? Or e to the 2 beta is equal to e to the minus 2 alpha, which is the same thing as e to the 2 alpha to the minus 1 power. So I get the same thing, but with the minus, the inverse here for r. And then I get my other stuff. And this constant, rs, is called the Schwarzschild radius. And we know classically that if r is much greater than 2gm, then you end up getting something that looks like Newtonian gravity at far away. And so all we need to do is show that rs is equal to 2gm, and we got Schwarzschild radius. We got the Schwarzschild solution. And this is called a asymptotically flat Minkowski spacetime, because as r goes to infinity, this just turns into Minkowski spacetime. In other words, you get far enough away from a gravitational field, it reverts to flat space. And you can see that that works here, because r goes to infinity, and these extra terms disappear, and you're just left with Minkowski space. Okay. So, this takes us to Birkhoff's theorem. And the idea of Birkhoff's theorem is that the Schwarzschild metric is the unique vacuum solution with spherical symmetry. In other words, you cannot come up with a different solution of Einstein's equations that work in spherical symmetry that are vacuum solutions, and that, you know, that are in, you know, so it's basically, this is the solution for that. If you add in a second black hole, it's no longer spherically symmetric. If you add in a spinning black hole, it's not spherically symmetric. You add in matter, it's not a vacuum solution. So there's all kind of things to change it. But as far as spherically symmetric vacuum solutions, this is it. Now, there are no time-dependent solutions of this form. You cannot add in time, because this is meant to be a static solution. And the proof of this is, first off, you can argue that spherically symmetric space-time can be
made into two dimensions, foiled by two spheres. Foliated by two spheres, sorry. And.
Foliated?
Yeah. That's the word. I didn't make it up.
I know, it's in the book.
Yeah. And for two, you can show geometry, or geometrically, that the metric on a spherically symmetric space can be written like this. So, you can show that if you have a spherically symmetric space, you can write its geometry something like this. Where you could see that this is tau, and this is the angular coordinates, and you could see that this is written at a certain constant r, basically. And in three, you can plug the metric into Einstein's equation for a vacuum and show that Schwarzschild solution is always what's going to pop out. So these are basically the three steps that you go through to prove that this is the unique solution.
That tau is not the proper time.
It's tau in this case is, I don't think I even say what it is, but it's not really proper time.
Dummy variable.
Yeah, it's a dummy coordinate.
But this is not proper time.
No, because you notice there's no minus sign on it.
Right.
But we'll get into exactly what it is. And, you know, the idea is that this is a two-sphere, so that's kind of why it's written like that. So, for spherically symmetric space-time, that means that it's going to have an SL3 symmetry. They're special orthogonal, three-dimensional. And that means that you can have, you're going to end up with three killing vectors. R, S, and T, where R is in the phi direction, S is in the theta direction, or some combination of theta and phi direction, and T is in the other combination of the two. And so these represent spinning about the z-axis, the y-axis, and the x-axis. And these killing vectors are, they're not going to commute, so that if you have the killing vector R and killing vector S, you try to commute them, you're going to get killing vector T. And S and T give you R, and T and R give you S. And so this is going to come out true if you have a spherically symmetric system. Yeah?
Foliated? What does that mean?
Oh, gosh. Foliated, I'm trying to think of their definition. Let me see. Their definition of foliated. It's like saying that you can, all the points are going to lie on a unique sphere, basically. So you can take a sphere and replace the space with this one sphere. It was the way they write it is, every point lies on a unique sphere that is invariant by the generators of spherical symmetry. Okay? I'm pretty sure there's a better definition out there, but that's just what they have. Okay. All right. Now, since the vector fields, you know, these killing vectors are vector fields, and they obey these commutation relationships, and are two spheres, a very... every point will be on exactly one of the spheres. And that's basically the proof of number one. So, you know, you think about it like this. You got all these vector fields, which are these killing vectors, and they obey these commutation relationships so that no matter how you combine these two killing vectors, you're still going to get another killing vector. And they're always going to stay on the two-sphere. And that's why they're saying that this spherical manifold, they can be foliated into spheres. And also you can just rewrite this spherical manifold to exist on a sphere. For two, theta and phi are the coordinates on each sphere. And A and B are going to be the coordinates of each sphere in the set. So imagine you've got several planets or spheres and they're all next to each other. Theta and phi are going to tell you where you are on a particular sphere, and A and B can tell you where each sphere is, you know, whether you're on Earth or Moon or Mars or whatever. And so A, B, theta, and phi are going to be the complete set of coordinates in M on the manifold. And so for each sphere, A equals A naught and B equals B naught on a chosen sphere. So you could say that your ds squared is a function of a naught, b naught, theta, and phi, where f of a naught and b naught are going to multiply by this coordinate for the angular coordinates. And so the way I like to think about this is imagine, just to draw this on the board, imagine this is the Earth, okay? And this is the Earth today. This is the Earth tomorrow. And this is the Earth next year. If you're on the surface of the Earth, then, you know, you can describe where you are in theta and phi. And basically what this is saying is you've kind of foliated this thing to say, well, this is the Earth today, this is the Earth tomorrow, this is the Earth in the future. And you can use alpha, A and B, to define, you know, kind of where you are in time and space between today and tomorrow. Because what's going to happen is the Earth today is located at this particular location, and, you know, you have these coordinates. But the Earth tomorrow, you're not just moving forward in time, but you're also, the Earth could be in a different place. So you need A and B to kind of describe, you know, where you are, where this Earth is. And that's where it gets to the further ones in the set. This is a way of thinking about it. So, if you fix theta equals theta naught and phi equals phi naught, then you could say that you're kind of eliminating, you're not really doing anything in terms of d omega. And you could say that ds squared is really just a function of a and b, and that's going to be in terms of d tau squared. So between this and this, this is where you fix yourself on a specific sphere, and you're just looking at the coordinates there. And this is where you fix the specific coordinates, but you're allowed to look at a different sphere. And the combination of those two gives you this whole thing.
And that's sort of the metric that they've got. And then this is the part where I skip a lot. Because if you look from page 200 to 201, they go from, they go from this equation I've got here, and they go through a series of coordinate changes. And this is something you need to look at because it's almost like a mathematical ballet of coordinate changes to go from one thing to the other. But eventually, what they end up with is to go from here to here. And it ends up ds squared is a function of t and r in r time and the angular coordinates. And m and n in this case represent the components of the metric. And so it's just, like I said, this is just something I don't want to bore you guys with class time with this, but this is something you can read through on your own and follow exactly what they're doing mathematically. And then ds squared for number three, which was once you've proven this equation for the metric, you're going to plug this metric into Einstein's equation for a vacuum and show that the Schwarzschild solution is unique. And so when they say plug that equation in,
What they really mean is basically plugging in this equation here with M and N. And so when you take this equation, and now we've just kind of written it with these exponentials, and we're using alpha and beta, same as before, except this time we're allowing alpha and beta be functions of R and T, not just functions of R. And if you do that, you got your Ricci
scalar,
and then your Ricci's tensors, and you can see each one of these Ricci terms. And they're very similar to what we had before, except now you have time derivatives, not just spatial derivatives. And in this case, you have a derivative of both. And so these are all the Ricci terms. And you know from before that all the Ricci terms have to go to zero. And also, you notice here, you even have this cross term that wasn't there before, which comes completely from the fact that you can have something moving, actually moving with time. So these are all equal to zero. And so this term equal to zero tells you that beta is only a function of position. It's not a function of time. And so that means that all the time derivatives of beta you see are going to go to zero. And this term here, where r theta is equal to zero, means that the time derivative of r theta is equal to zero, which means the time derivative of the spatial derivative of alpha is equal to zero, which means that alpha could be thought of as one function of space and one function of time. And this is sort of like what we did with the wave equation in math methods. And so if you choose that you're going to have your time written in terms of this exponential, this function of time times time, then you can kind of eliminate the time function out of it. And the reason why is because if you think about it, this is basically saying that time varies with time, which doesn't make any sense. And so you can kind of get rid of that actual function of time and kind of argue that away, and in which case you just have alpha just depending on space, just through coordinate transformation. And so you end up again by eliminating the time dependence from the metric. And so this shows that the metric is independent of time. And if the metric is independent of time, any spatially symmetric vacuum metric is going to have a time-like killing vector. And that proves Birkhoff's theorem. In other words, since this thing doesn't change in time, then it doesn't matter how you move forward in time, it's going to be the same. And if it's going to be the same, then all the time-like, it's going to have a time-like killing vector. And so also, because this solution here looks exactly like what we had before, this proves that you're always going to end up with the same solution for the Schwarzschild metric. Now also, we have this term called stationary that we use. And stationary means that the metric possesses a killing vector that is time-like near infinity. In other words, you basically have a time-like path that the metric can follow and give you something that doesn't change. And static, on the other hand, means that the metric possesses a time-like killing vector that is orthogonal to the family of hypersurfaces. So in other words, stationary means, you know, you have something and it's not moving. And static means that it literally doesn't change in time. Like, you know, it doesn't shrink or expand or anything like that. And so if you put the two of them together, you got something that just sits there kind of boring. And so in general, if you write your metric like this, where you have your metric term as a function of position and your spatial metric terms as a function of position,
And you can see that this is time symmetric because it's not changing in time. And so a stationary metric basically means, well, static means that this metric is not a function of time. Stationary would mean that there are no cross terms between time and space. Another way of interpreting that. Okay. All right, now the next thing we want to talk about are singularities. And
this is the interesting stuff. Now, when you talk about the Schwarzschild solution, the whole idea of it was that it explained the gravity outside the Earth or outside of the Sun. But it's pretty easy to see that, you know, if you take certain extreme conditions of this, and let's say you had a really, really microscopic mass that was really, really big enough to cause all this curvature, then you get some really interesting physics. And what happens is that if you look at this metric,
the full Schwarzschild metric,
on the first page,
then you could see that if you take R equal to zero, at R equals zero, this goes to negative infinity, and this goes to negative infinity. And so both of these terms just blow up. And at R equals 2gm, then you can see that this becomes 1 minus 1, which is 0. And this thing becomes 1 minus 1, which is 0. And so the thing is, if this becomes infinite, and this becomes 1 over infinite, then you've got 0 here, and you've got infinity here. If this becomes 0, and this becomes 0, then that's going to be 1 over 0, and that's going to be infinite. So you're going to have infinities pop up in your metric. And so that's what happens at these two particular points. And so when you get infinities in classical physics, it kind of implies that something is wrong.
Because if the metric is infinite, then the curvature is going to be infinite at these points. And because the curvature depends on the metric, but the scalars don't depend on the coordinates. So if you move them out to infinity, then you should be able to get rid of the singularity by just kind of rescaling everything. And so the scalars that you can get are, first off, the Ricci scalar. And then the contraction would be Ricci tensor and its inverse, and the Riemann and its inverse, and, you know, et cetera. And so what we want to do is consider a point non-singular if it has well-behaved geodesics. In other words, if you have a point and it can follow a geodesic continuously, and the geodesic doesn't just stop or, you know, change or, you know, run into a singularity, then you can consider that non-singular. So for Schwarzschild, you could see that this contraction of the Riemann gives you 48 g squared m squared over r to the sixth. And at r equals zero, this blows up to infinity, and you get an infinite scalar. But at r equals 2gm, you could see that this is not going to blow up. And so, since the scalar here is not blowing up, then that means that this is really not a singularity. And so we call this a coordinate singularity, because it's possible when you're dealing with a coordinate singularity to kind of rescale your coordinates in order to remove the singularity. And so 2GM is also called the event horizon of the black hole, and it's also called the Schwarzschild radius, all these terms. And if you look at any mass, you can always come up with a 2GM for any mass. It's just that when you deal with something like the Sun, that 2GM is actually inside of the star. And when you get inside the star, all your assumptions about it being a vacuum fall apart. So a black hole is the definition, by definition, it's a star that exists with inside of its Schwarzschild radius. Even the Earth has a Schwarzschild radius, but you have to have all the mass inside of that in order to have a black hole. And so next time, what we're going to do is we're going to continue on with this, and we're going to talk about the geodesics of a Schwarzschild radius, and a lot of that is really what you need to work, you know, you need for this homework assignment I gave out last time. And the idea is that if you are a particle and you're forced to be in an orbit around something like a black hole, and you have to follow that geodesic around, then this can tell you a little bit about how you would behave, what you'd follow. And you could see that if you, you know, outside of a star, like if you could actually treat the sun like the Schwarzschild radius until you hit the surface of the star. If you could make the sun smaller and fit it inside its Schwarzschild radius, it would be exactly the same. But then when you get close to that Schwarzschild radius, that's when everything changes. And when you get inside of it, that's when things really get interesting. That's, you know, inspired 1,000 sci-fi movies. Okay, any questions? I know a lot of this today was just going through this derivation, but I think that when you look at this, and you'll see why it is there's actually two chapters on the black hole stuff and only one on things like cosmology and gravitational waves. And it's just because there's been a lot of research on it, because that's when a lot of really interesting things happen. So that you'll get to some physics under black holes that you just won't see anywhere else. Okay. All right, well, I'll see you guys next time.